Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Since the end of World War II, the Atlantic Alliance between the United States and the countries of Western Europe has been a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy. Of course, there have been strains over the year, but today, after the U.S. decision to withdraw from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran, better known as the Iranian nuclear deal, this relationship with key U.S. allies has been seriously fractured. My guest today believes perhaps beyond easy repair. Dr. Charles Kupchan is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He also serves as a professor of international affairs at the Walsh School of Foreign Service and the Department of Government at Georgetown University. From 2014 to 2017, he served as the special assistant to the president and senior director for European affairs on the staff of the National Security Council in the Obama administration. He also served as a director for European affairs on the NSC during the Clinton administration. He previously worked at the U.S. Department of State, and he's also taught at Princeton University. He's the author of several books. His most recent is No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. Kupchan was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last Thursday, speaking on America First, Does the Atlantic Partnership Have a Future? I spoke with him that afternoon, which was the day that President Trump tweeted his withdrawal from the Singapore summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Charles Kupchan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
In the wake of the U.S. decision to withdraw from the Iranian nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, we heard many European leaders stating at the time that this marked a new chapter in the U.S.-European relationship, a major change in how they view their relationship with the U.S., and not for the better, at least from what we've expected with U.S.-European relations. Do you think this is rhetoric at the time, or does this really mark an end of their reliance on the U.S.?
I think that the Europeans have, since Donald Trump took office, essentially been trying to not give in, but not give up. Not give in the sense that if the U.S. pulls out of the Paris Climate Agreement, they're going to stick with it. If the U.S. pulls out of a trade deal, they're going to stick with it. I think we've hit an inflection point in which the Europeans are now saying, can we continue this? Well, we don't love the guy, but we're going to try to keep working with him. Can we continue to do that now that he has pulled out of the Iran deal and essentially made it a situation where the U.S. is working in a direction that is fundamentally at odds with the direction the Europeans are heading in? And so I think there's a rethink going on now. It's too soon to know where they're going to land, but there clearly is a conversation taking place about how Europe can push back against the Trump administration, both in terms of upholding the Iran deal, but also retaliating if the United States imposes sanctions against European companies for continuing to do business with Iran. We'll find out in the coming weeks just how explosive this difference of opinion is.
We're struck by something you wrote or said at one point after this. It says, you know, we've had frequent tiffs with the Europeans over the Iraq War, about U.S. surveillance of allies when that came to public knowledge during the Obama administration. It says, but it was always breaches in the means, not actually the ends. Does that mark something fundamentally different in your view?
Yes, it does. And I think it's one reason that we are passing through a moment of history that is as unsettling as any we've been in I really think, since World War II. And that's that since the end of World War II, the United States and its key democratic allies have essentially been driving toward the same goals, and that is an international system anchored on liberal values and institutions, predicated upon capitalism, predicated upon the spread of democracy. States have agreed to adhere to what we call a rules-based system. And now we have a situation in which that's no longer the case. There were bad days during the George W. Bush administration, when the U.S. attacked Iraq. A lot of Europeans were thinking, what is going on here? But we were still pursuing the same ends. They thought that it was a mistake to try to spread democracy by attacking Iraq, but the Bush administration was actually pursuing the broader goal of spreading this Western order. We now have in the United States an administration that thinks that this order was a bad deal for the United States, that it's now America first rather than America together with its allies, And that really does mark a historical inflection point in which the Atlantic democracies writ large are no longer using the same playbook.
Beyond using the same playbook, the idea that you've had now three presidential administrations in which the pendulum has seemingly swung one direction, back the other, and back the other, is it possible they just consider us unreliable? Someone they can't really depend on?
I think that that's a good way to put it. You know, my best guess is that here in the United States, the pendulum will swing back. I think there's a reasonable chance that Donald Trump will be reelected, but I wouldn't bet my money on it. But the problem is that when, let's say he is not reelected, are we going to swing back far in the other direction, that if there's whiplash among our allies? And part of the problem that I think we face as Americans is that our political center has been depopulated. The Republican Party has moved further and further to the right. The Democratic Party, I don't think, has gone to the extremes in the same way that the Republican Party has, but it's certainly moved further and further to the left. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that we are seeing broad swings in domestic policy, in foreign policy. When the pendulum swings, it goes, because there's no one to catch it.
There's no moderate force.
Right. And I think that one of the anomalies is that many Americans are still in the center. In fact, I would say the majority of Americans are still moderate, centrist, reasonable people going through their lives. But when you look at our political system, it has been captured by the extremes. And we Americans who still are in the center, and I put myself there, need to figure out how we are going to get our political system back in line with those of us who are still in the middle of the political spectrum.
Now, Iran today has said that Europe must continue to buy Iranian oil and protect its banking and markets from the impact of U.S. sanctions. This was the Supreme Leader saying this today, in order for them to continue to abide by the nuclear deal. Do you think Europe will do that?
I think Europe would like to do that. And they have been meeting, working around the clock to figure out ways to continue to do business. The problem is that European business leaders may have a different view. And that is, if you're, let's say, Total, a large French energy company, or you're Siemens, a large German electronics company, and they build generators and a little bit like General Electric, and you are doing business in Iran, but it represents 1% of your global business or less, and then you hear that the U.S. financial system is going to cut you off if you stay in Iran, what are you going to do? My guess is you're going to leave, because that 1% is not worth suffering the imposition of sanctions by the U.S. Treasury Department. So I think what will happen is the Europeans will discuss ways to try to keep the deal alive, to try to keep some money flowing into the country, to try to tell the Iranians, don't start up your centrifuges and enrich uranium again, because we're worried about what's around the corner. But I do think they're going to have a hard time keeping the private sector planted in Iran.
And if the European governmental leadership would like them to continue to do business, what pressure would the U.S. realistically offer? Do you think we would be willing to impose sanctions on European businesses that do business with Iran? Do you think we're actually willing to do that?
I think we will do that.
Really?
In fact, the Trump administration has made it clear that after a certain period, I believe it's a 90 to 180-day grace period, if European companies are in breach, we will apply what are called secondary sanctions. That is, we will take steps to freeze assets or cut off the clearing rights of companies that are working within the American financial system. And that's when we will probably hit a moment of reckoning, in part because companies will then have to choose, are we going to pay that penalty? But also because European governments are then going to say, are we prepared to go to the mat? Are we, for example, prepared to impose retaliatory sanctions against Citibank or against some other American company that is providing services in Europe? If the answer to that question is yes, then I think we really are in a brave new world, because not only would the United States and its traditional allies not be working together, they would be working against each other. You know, I think that the deal to some extent represents the straw breaking the camel's back, in that There have been many moments at which Europeans have gasped and said, oh, here we go again. And whether it's on immigration, the Muslim ban, or pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, or saying we're pulling out of NAFTA, we're pulling out of Trans-Pacific Partnership, we're imposing steel and aluminum tariffs on Europe, you know, they try to take a deep breath. And I think European elites realize that life without the American friend is lonely and dangerous, and that's because it would be. And they're trying to keep the relationship on an even keel, but they face publics. They are also electoral democracies. And you had Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, come over here a few weeks ago. He spends a few days hugging and kissing President Trump, and he goes home empty-handed. A few days later, Angela Merkel comes back to the United States and again pleads for the Iran deal, pleads for free trade, and she goes home empty-handed. That puts them in a very awkward position where they may at some point be forced by domestic pressure to start taking steps to retaliate.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, this was a public rebuke because you did have these leaders coming, either coming to speak to President Trump in private, or in the case of certain politicians, I think Boris Johnson, making public appeals within the House of Commons or, you know, in very public institutions, basically imploring the president not to take this step. And yet he did.
That's exactly what happened. And as you can imagine, there has been a domestic backlash in each of the countries. In the UK, the domestic backlash over the last year is so bad that Trump actually had to cancel a visit and turn down an invitation from the Queen for a state visit. Now it looks like he's going to go back to the UK in July, but we will see. And this, you know, this is worrisome because it may be that whoever comes to power after Trump will be presiding over a Western world that is in rubble because the institutions have atrophied, because our friends don't trust us anymore, because it costs them when they stand shoulder to shoulder with the American president. This is an unrecognizable moment in the politics of the liberal West.
Let me ask you about the ZTE deal. This is a Chinese telecom firm which did business with the Iranians through the sanctions era prior to the agreement, and the Trump administration seemingly saying, well, we'll work something out. Now, that has got to play bad for, you know, an administration at the same time that is threatening all the multinationals of Europe severe sanctions if they try to do business with Iran. How does that look?
Well, the first, you know, by the time we finish this interview,
that will have changed.
That may well have changed. Because you wake up in the morning and policy on ZTE has changed. Yesterday, we're meeting Kim Jong-un. Today, we're not. Tomorrow, we are. I cannot overstate the degree to which there is chaos in Washington, in which the president makes decisions on a rather impulsive basis that have not been run through a normal policy process. But yes, I do agree with you. First, he says we're sanctioning ZTE. Then it appears that he had a conversation either directly with the president of China or through his envoys in which the request came to please not sanction ZTE, and so our policy has changed. But there is a cost that's being imposed on Trump with his base, I think, and that is they want sanctions against China and others that they see as stealing American jobs. And so I do think that because we are now in the lead-in to the midterms, the numbers don't look great for the Republicans. Donald Trump has one play, and that is to whip up the base. He is going to be playing the protectionist card, because I think that appeals to them a lot more than the other stuff that's in the hopper. They don't care that much about the summit with North Korea. They don't care that much about the Iran deal, but they do care a lot about what they see as the best way to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States.
My guest today is Charles Kupchan, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations who served in the National Security Council in both the Obama and Clinton administrations. He's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on America First, Does the Atlantic Partnership Have a Future? Earlier, you mentioned, you know, the danger of not having an American friend. That's how you termed it as far as Europe goes. What are the dangers of not having, for Europe, of not having an American friend?
Well, I think the dangers are mutual, in the sense that the United States has been the pacifier and the protector of Europe since the end of World War II. We've had many American troops there at sometimes tens of thousands. We've now got hundreds of thousands. Now we have tens of thousands. And Europe has enjoyed the benefits of protection from the United States. Who knows what would happen if that partnership falls apart? Will European nations go after each other? Will the border between France and Germany come back to life as a place where people die? Will Vladimir Putin say, hey, Uncle Sam's gone. I think I'm going to mess around in Poland or Estonia or some part of NATO's eastern flank. And for the United States, we will lose the main companion that we have had over the last 80 years in pursuing common interests. If we go back a few decades, America plus Europe plus Japan equaled almost 80% of global GDP. That number has now shrunk to below 50% and will continue to decline. And who's coming up? China. Other countries that are not out there trying to defend an order that is conducive to the American way of life and to American values. If we're not working together with countries that share those values, then the 21st century is going to be a very bumpy century in which we cede place to those who are not liberal democracies, who don't share the same history and the same values that we do. And therefore, I think we will all be worse off if the United States and Europe end up going in their separate directions.
From an economic basis, Europe has made its position clear. Even if the United States is pulling out of trade agreements, they're going to continue to make trade agreements in their best interests with China's, with Southeast Asia, with wherever they can make a trade agreement.
They are trying to hold down the fort, as it were. I don't think that President Trump is misguided in saying that we need to make sure that the average American has a job and is earning a living wage in the year 2025, because right now the prospects are bleak. He's asking the right question. What are average Americans going to do to earn a living wage? The problem is that he's got the wrong answer. Slapping protectionist tariffs on German cars, putting tariffs on Chinese imports, building a wall with Mexico, that's not going to do the trick. What will happen is the flat screen TVs that Americans buy at Walmart are going to be 20% more, and your wages may go up 1%. That's not a great deal. And so we need to have a national discussion about what economy do we need to build? How are we going to get broadband access into parts of the United States where the economy has been lagging? How are we going to get the healthcare industry? How are we going to get data processing? We need to get growth sectors into what is traditionally called the Rust Belt. Protectionism is not the right answer. He's asking the right question, but we need to do a better job of getting the right result.
I want to go back to a comment you mentioned. You said, you know, one of the things the United States has provided in Europe is it's been a pacifier of European rivalries. And I think a lot of people would say, oh, that era is long gone. You know, World War II, of course, we said it after World War I, too, but World War II put it into these European rivalries. If the United States is not actively involved in Europe in the same way we've come to expect, if we're at loggerheads about our ultimate goals, does that risk reigniting those traditional European rivalries?
You know, if we've been having this conversation maybe 5, certainly 10 years ago, I would have said, listen, Europe has escaped its past. History is over. Let's go see a movie and grab a beer. The problem is that we can't say that anymore. And that's because the British held a referendum and they've decided to exit the European Union. And they are now committing one of the most stunning acts of self-harm that any nation has committed in a long time. They're extracting themselves from Europe. Poland and Hungary now have governments that are, I would say, borderline democratic, but certainly illiberal. Italy has just elected a government that is pro-Russian, that is anti-European, that is populist. And so one has to say, is the European revolution that led to a Europe at peace, is that slipping away? Are borders coming back to life? Is nationalism and nativism triumphing over pluralism? Are we going to see anti-Semitism run rampant again? In this country, are we seeing a kind of unraveling of a multi-ethnic fabric that the United States has done such a successful job of building since World War II? I can't answer that question, But the fact that you and I are sitting here suggesting that these are realistic possibilities is quite sobering. We are clearly seeing a situation in which in many parts of Europe, governments are abandoning the center. They are heading toward the left and the right extremes. And nativism and nationalism is returning in a way that I think many of us thought we would never see.
Let's talk about another idea that we thought was long dead too, which is a new era of isolationism for the United States. I think most foreign policy observers thought it unlikely at the beginning of the Trump administration. I thought it was more a term of rhetoric rather than reality. What's your thought approaching the 18-month milepost of the Trump presidency? Are we perhaps entering a new era of isolationism?
I think that if there is a new sweet spot in the American electorate moving forward, it will be not isolationism per se, but something that I would call retrenchment, a foreign policy in which the United States maintains its central foreign commitments but does lighten its load. Here's another example of where I think President Trump is asking the right question but giving the wrong answer. He's asking, and asked as a candidate, what are we doing in Afghanistan? What are we doing in Syria, in Iraq? Why did we topple Gaddafi? What do we have to show for this? Those are good questions. I ask myself once a day, why are we trying to turn Afghanistan into Ohio? Why are we sending more American troops there when the country does not seem to be coming together? Now, the problem is that Trump has actually increased force levels in Afghanistan, hasn't really shown us a roadmap for reducing commitments. But I do think that his instincts are very much in those directions. He's talked about getting out of Syria. He's asked the Pentagon for a plan for withdrawing troops from South Korea. So his instincts are very much reminiscent and resonant with what came before World War II, which is an America that is much more stingy when it comes to putting its forces in harm's way, putting its blood and treasure on the line. I hope that we don't go back to an isolationism a la the 1930s. But on the other hand, I think many Americans think that we have bitten off more than we can chew, and that it is time to pull back on the reins and do a better job of husbanding our resources.
Well, if I can shift the focus to the Far East, which I know is not your primary level of focus, but as we speak today, the Trump administration decided to withdraw from the Singapore summit with Kim Jong-un. What's your immediate reaction to this? Was this a good idea to begin with? Is it, you know, what's your thoughts?
I would say my main critique of the way that the North Korea situation has been handled is that it's just amateurish. I have no objection to a summit between the American president and the leader of North Korea, but you can't just wake up in the morning and say, hey, let's have a summit. You have to do the hard work. You have to lay the groundwork. You have to have a strategy for going from open hostility to mutual concessions to building trust to end of the story, denuclearization and a peace treaty. None of that homework seems to have been done. I think the president just decided on the spur of the moment, hey, I want to meet this guy. And so they started down that road. And then lo and behold, it appears that the North Koreans aren't going to take all their nuclear weapons and put them in the garbage can tonight. And so now, I guess, what's happening in the Trump administration is they're starting to go back and doing the homework that they should have done early on, because you can't really have the president of the United States fly to Singapore, meet with the leader of North Korea, and come home with nothing. And I think they began to see that that was the most likely outcome.
Yeah. What about this idea where they're throwing out the Libya scenario? First John Bolton and then Vice President Pence comes out with this, even after there's criticism after the first time the Libya scenario is played out. You know, why are they throwing that out there? Was it to sabotage the agreement or the agreement to meet or what?
I think it was probably just one of those errors that comes along in the course of the day, in that John Bolton was seemingly trying to say, here's a good example of how we went from a country that had a WMD, a weapons of mass destruction program, and we were able to completely shut it down. The problem is twofold. One, we then proceeded to invade the country And the leader, Gaddafi, was chased around and then basically killed by the mob. And then Libya fell apart and was overrun by extremist jihadists. Great. That really worked well, didn't it? The other problem is that North Korea has nuclear weapons. They have an ace in the hole. And that means that the whole issue of negotiations, of finding a way to get them to get rid of their ace in the hole, is it's a much, much higher hurdle. And so it's not a particularly good example. And it does create, again, a situation in which it looks like they just didn't think this through before they started down the road.
Getting back to your expertise in Europe, over the next 30 to 60 to 90 days, maybe 180 days, the decisions will be made by European companies on how, and European governments on how they react to the withdrawal from the nuclear deal. What would be a worrisome sign? What would be things we should be looking for that'll come out over the next 6 months as they begin to work through this idea of the United States not being part of an agreement in which the Iranians, by all objective observers, are holding up at the present time?
I would watch for two things. One is, does the deal slip away despite Europe's best efforts to keep it going? And if so, do we then move into what you could call the zone of conflict, in which the Iranians begin to engage in activities, either on the nuclear front or attacking targets in Iraq or attacking American targets in Syria, in which we are then faced with the prospect of a U.S.-Iranian conflict? And there are members of the Trump administration who said, ooh, that's not such a bad idea. Mm. And the other is that the relationship between Europe and the United States just continues to go south. Even though I think the Europeans would be justified in taking what you might call vindictive steps against the Trump administration, I hope they don't. And that's because I do worry that the best thing to do right now is try to keep the fundamentals of the relationship from deteriorating. At the working level, keep the corridors of communication open and hope for better days, hope for better leadership over the horizon. Because as I said, the worst outcome is that we have someone come in after Trump and the Western institutions, the Western community is basically in a pile of rubble.
Charles Kupchan, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Charles Kupchan is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and previously served on the National Security Council in the Obama and Clinton administrations. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last Thursday, speaking on America First. Does the Atlantic Partnership have a future? Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.